Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Tim Besley, Professor of Economics and Political Science here at the LSE. It's my great pleasure to welcome you this evening to the first of the Lionel Robbins Lectures of 2005. And it's a particular source of pleasure to welcome members of Lionel Robbins' family, his daughter Anne Johnson and his son-in-law Christopher Johnson, who are in the audience this evening. Our lecturer this evening is Andre Schleifer, who is Whipple V.N. Jones Professor of Economics at Harvard University. Andre is, I'm sure, known to you all by reputation. Like me, many of you will also know him personally. Having only recently given a rather lengthier introduction to Andre's achievements when he received a distinguished prize in Munich, I'm thinking actually of applying for a job as his permanent warm-up act. Andre was an undergraduate at Harvard and gained his PhD from MIT. He taught subsequently at Chicago and Princeton before returning to his alma mater. He has many professional honors, including being a fellow of the Econometric Society and recipient of the highly prestigious John Bates Clark Medal, a sort of junior Nobel Prize. His contributions range over all areas of economics, finance, development, public economics, political economy, and law and economics. I'm sure I've left some out there. His research productivity is extraordinary, and he's an applied economist in the best tradition, with his work focusing on issues of immense importance. He works on challenging problems and influences the way in which people think about them. I have to say that he's excelled himself in his choice of title for this year's Robbins Lectures, The DNA of a Market Economy. Andre has reinvigorated the field of law and economics through his work. His lectures will, I'm sure, pull together the work that he's been doing in recent years to understand sometimes unwritten rules behind the workings of markets. Andre, it gives me immense pleasure to welcome you to the LSE this evening, and we're all looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor for me to be here and to give the Robbins Lectures. I remember it was maybe 15 years ago that my mentor, Larry Summers, had his opportunity to give the Robbins Lectures, and I remember his excitement about them and having the opportunity to talk about the issues of governance that that he's talked about. And I am just as excited and probably more excited as he was. So the topic of these lectures is the DNA of a market economy. So let me say a few words about why this title. In the last 50 years or so, since the discovery of the structure of DNA, biology has become a science of information. Information about living things is coded in their DNA and transmitted from parents to children. In the course of evolution, DNA changes, and one can understand differences among species and among individuals by looking at differences in their DNA. Behavior can be understood to a significant extent by looking at DNA and genes. I will try to argue in these lectures that societies and economies in general, and market economies in particular, can be understood analogously. They have patterns of culture, politics, and institutions that vary systematically among them. These patterns constitute each society's DNA, the crucial information that shapes its operation. Moreover, through conquest and colonization, some societies inherit this information from their conquerors and colonizers who bring with them their human capital, their language, their religion, their laws, their sports, their culture, and so on. And as a consequence, the pieces of the DNA become part of the fabric of the colonized and conquered societies that they share with the conquerors and colonizers. Differences in these pieces of DNA may explain differences among market economies. I will focus in these lectures on one particular piece of DNA, namely legal systems, but the points will apply more generally. Now, a good starting point is a book by two American historians that I read maybe a year or two ago that made a huge impression on me. This is a book by William McNeil and his son, J.R. McNeil, called The Human Web. The book covers all of human history in about 300 pages. The authors show that information travels with people, and that this transmission of information, that transplantation of social DNA, shapes human societies. Information is transmitted through trade, through conquest, through colonization, through missionaries, through migrants, and so on. The pieces of information transmitted include technology, going back to bow and arrow and various crops, language, religion, if you think about the spread of Christianity or Islam, sports, culture, but also laws and legal systems. Economists have traditionally focused on the transfers of technology, but there is obviously much more. Such transplantation creates common pieces of economic and institutional DNA in different countries. Some of these pieces of DNA are transplanted voluntarily. For example, much of technology adoption through trade is largely endogenous. People take up what they need. This makes it difficult to study the consequences of adoption because we do not know whether to attribute these consequences to what is adopted or to the conditions that cause the adoption. In other instances, the transplantation is involuntary, as in the cases of forced religious conversion, conquest, or colonization. These conditions, unattractive as they may seem from a moral point of view, make it easier to study consequences of differences in the economic DNA of different countries. I will focus on one aspect of such transmission of DNA, namely that of the transplantation of legal systems through conquest and colonization. About a decade ago, Rafael Laporta, Florencio Lopez de Silanes, Robert Vishny, and I initiated this research in a pair of papers dealing with law and finance. Since then, the idea that colonial experience can be used to study institutional differences among countries has been fruitfully taken up by a number of other scholars, including Daron Acemoglu, as discussed in his Robbins lectures last year. In this year's lectures, I will focus primarily on the work done by my collaborators and myself, trying to take stock and to develop some generalizations, although I should be clear that many other scholars have fruitfully developed these ideas. So let me get to some of the details of what I'm going to talk about. There are basically five major legal systems in the world today. Common law, which is the law of England and its colonies. French civil law, which is the law of France, but also Spain, Portugal, and their colonies, German civil law, Nordic law, and socialist law. This map, which I'll talk about, describes the map of the spread of these legal traditions around the world through conquest and colonization. Now, you can see here in yellow or green or whatever it is that it looks back there, is yellow corresponds to England and the laws of England. So you can see that the laws of England have been transplanted to its colonies, including the United States and Canada, Australia, India, as well as a number of countries in East Africa and in the south of Africa. French law has been transplanted first by Napoleonic conquest from France to various countries in Western Europe, including Spain, Portugal, and Italy, and from there, again, through conquest to all of Latin America, Mexico, North Africa, large parts of West Africa, and several countries in Asia. German law, German legal system, which developed much later than common law and the French civil law, and was codified only at the time of Bismarck, is basically, it's in blue here, is the law of Germany, Switzerland, Czech Republic, and Austria, that is to say the laws of Germanic countries in Europe, but they've also been transplanted largely voluntarily to Japan in the second half of the 19th century, and from there to several countries that have been occupied by Japan, including Korea. The Nordic laws form a family that occupies, of course, the small but important part of the world, the Nordic countries, and there are some debates as to whether, in fact, they constitute a family or whether they're all different. And finally, there is a socialist legal tradition, which is the laws of the Soviet Union and of the countries that have been influenced by the Soviet Union. Now, because legal systems spread through conquest and colonization, we can evaluate their consequences for various economic outcomes. We can also, through this process, try to understand better how institutions affect market economies, and in particular, as I will argue in these lectures, what are the consequences of the different roles a government might play in the economy. This, in fact, is one of the central questions of economics and development. Although I've described five areas of different legal traditions a moment ago, I will focus today on the differences between French civil law and common law, since these differences are best understood and cover by far the most countries. German civil law includes very few countries and hardly any poor ones. Nordic law covers only four countries. Socialist law is actually very hard to study econometrically in the way in which I will do in these lectures, mostly because the majority of economies that used to have socialist law have been transitioning out of socialist law to go either back to their pre-World War II legal systems or to some mixtures of legal systems by various countries. So legally speaking, they're truly in transition. Although I should say that from the point of view of the theoretical perspective that I'll try to develop, socialism fits into the picture in the sense that socialist law is in fact an example of the most radical form of government intervention into the society and the economy. But from my point of view, and to illustrate the points, I will focus on common law versus French civil law. So my topic for the first lecture is how are common and civil law, the laws of England and of France, and I'll focus on mother countries to begin with, different and why. Let me first say that I focus, at least in this lecture, on ideal types. Obviously, not all common law countries have the same laws, and there is convergence across systems, at least in some dimensions. But there are some basic differences in the ideal types recognized in every single comparative law textbook. At the purely legal level, the differences between common and civil law appear to be the following. In civil law countries, the law is codified. There are codes that supposedly give judges instructions as to what to do in specific circumstances, and these codes are perpetrated by the legislature or the sovereign. In common law countries, there is judge-made law. That is to say, a lot of the legal rules are created not by codes, not through codes by legislatures, but through a process of judicial decision-making by appellate courts. In civil law countries, the argument takes written form. That is to say, judges collect evidence and put it, write it down, and there is a written transcript of what the testimony and the evidence suggests. In common law countries, there is much more emphasis on oral argument, that is to say, oral testimony in court oral trials, and so on. In civil law countries, juries tend to play a much less important role. Relatively few trials are jury trials as opposed to trials where judges make decisions. In common law countries, juries tend to be much more important. In civil law countries, the appeal is nearly automatic. That is to say, just about every judicial decision is reviewed by a high-level court. In common law countries, in contrast, appeal tends to be relatively infrequent. And perhaps most importantly, and this is something I will emphasize in a moment, civil law countries have state-employed judges, which basically report to the executive branch of the government, have civil service judges, state-employed judges, who basically report to the executive branch of the government, whereas common law countries have independent judges who are often appointed for life and do not report to the executive. I think there is a more general way to describe this difference, which is the one I'll emphasize, which is the French civil law tends to stand for a system of distrust of judges and trust in legislatures and sovereigns. The common law system tends to stand for distrust of legislators and kings and the trust of judges. These represent quite different approaches to law enforcement and to the nature of sovereign control over the judiciaries. And what I'll try to argue in this lecture, this has profound consequences for the organization of the economy. Now, what I try to do in the next part of this lecture is a bit of amateur history and try to ask the question, why did these different systems of law evolve in England and in France? And why it is the case that common and civil law have diverged? What is the nature of this divergence? Well, there are basically two very different or complementary views of divergence. The more traditional view of how the two legal systems have diverged is the Enlightenment view, which is associated with the work of many authors, but in particular was described very clearly by Hayek in his Constitution of Liberty. What this view argues is that during the English Revolution of the 17th century, lawyers and judges were basically on the winning side. And hence, judicial independence, as epitomized by the Settlement Act of 1701, was a reflection of the desire of Parliament to create an extra check on absolutism. After the French Revolution, in contrast, and especially in the First Empire, lawyers and judges were opposed to the regime, particularly to the regime of Napoleon, and hence Napoleon, through his code, wanted to make them mere automata, totally subordinate to the will of the legislature and the executive. These potential differences 200 years ago led to different systems, and spread through conquest and colonization, as I've shown you on the map. An alternative view, which I should say I tend to favor, sees the differences going back not to 17th and 18th century, but going as far back as the 12th and 13th centuries. It holds that England was a relatively peaceful country in which decentralized dispute resolution on the testimony of independent knights, which was what the juries was efficient. France, in contrast, was a much less peaceful country in which high nobles had the power to subvert decentralized justice, and hence a much more centralized system, organized, maintained, and protected by the sovereign, was required to administer justice. Roman law provided the backbone of such a system. This view sees the developments of 17th and 18th centuries as reinforcing the structures already present, and in England, undoing the deviations toward the courts of royal prerogative prior to the revolution. So let me present a framework, which I'll keep coming back to throughout these lectures, that tries to interpret this history. So I want to ask two questions again. given my amateur interpretation of history. But I should say this is in defense of what I'm about to say, this is not so different from what historians of English law, both American historians such as Dawson, Berman, and Damasca, write, but also this is not very different from Maitland's interpretation, if you want to go back to legal divinity. So why did different legal systems evolve in England and France, and why are these differences expressed both in the organization of legal systems and with different social and economic outcomes, and as I will try to show you in these lectures. So what I want to do is to make this argument, which is based on the central distinction of strategies for law enforcement and different levels of sovereign control over judges. The common law system being the system of lay judges and juries, the civil law system being the system of state-employed judges. And I will try to argue that these differences go back to 12th and 13th centuries. So what is the key issue in thinking about this problem? Well, the key issue, I would argue, is how to protect law enforcers, the judges, from being bullied, and by that I mean both physically and through bribes, by local feudal lords. I would submit to you that this is, in fact, a central problem of law enforcement, not just in 12th and 13th century England and France, but in many developing countries today, which is how it is that you protect judges and juries and law enforcers from being overpowered by the local special interests who have both the economic and the military power to get their way in court. What I would argue is that when bullying is moderate, it is efficient to leave adjudication to local decision makers who are better informed and less biased, and that, I would argue, is a system that England had in the 12th century. Whereas when bullying is extreme, that is to say when local interests are extremely powerful, it is efficient to leave adjudication to state-employed judges. They may be more biased, they may reflect the preferences of the king, but they may be more resistant to bullying because of incentives. Now, I will take one other point of view, which may be even more extreme, which is that I will argue that the legal systems that have emerged in the two countries were efficient. That is to say that the system that emerged in England was efficient for England, and the system that emerged in France was efficient from France. And in fact, I'll try to interpret Magna Carta as, in fact, a way in which the nobles and the sovereign in England have negotiated an efficient outcome. And furthermore, I will try to suggest that codification emerges as a natural consequence of a civil law system and its need to control judges. So here is a brief version of history before I do theory, which is, as I indicated, France and England diverged in the 12th and 13th century. And here is the one-slide history of English and French law. So in England in the 12th century, Henry II introduces the institution of the jury, which is basically that there are a few royal judges who go from village to village. They assemble the local knights, and they ask them a question or collection of questions. Who took whose land since the last time we were here, or who murdered whom? And the knights answer this question upon our oath, and then the king's judges make decisions or adjudicate disputes. Now, this way of resolving disputes has a fundamental problem, which is, of course, if it is a powerful local feudal lord who took the land of a weaker person, the knights or the jurors need to have no fear that if they tell the truth to the king's judge, they're going to be killed. They need to have some level of security from this kind of punishment. Likewise, if they make a decision against a friend of the king, give evidence against a friend of the king, they need to have some assurance that the king will not punish them. And in fact, one of the fundamental principles of Magna Carta is that no person may be immersed without the judgment of his peers. Now, this system of decision-making by juries, or at least information provision by juries, survives in England for a long time. It adopts its modern form in around the 14th century. Then, of course, there is a long deviation in the 15th and 16th century, maybe in 16th and 17th, as the sovereign tries to undo this system and create the separate courts of royal prerogative. But then, following the revolution in the 17th century, this modern system of judges appointed for life and the jury trial takes its form. And so England stays with the system of independent judiciaries and decision-making by juries. France goes in a very, very different direction. In the 13th century, Philip Augustus and Louis IX moved to a model of a judge inquisitor inspired by Roman law. In 1256, Louis IX organizes Parlement de Paris as an appeals court, and the system of centralized justice is basically created in a way that it exists today. Very little emphasis on juries, state-employed judges, and codification of rules, as well as nearly automatic appeal. So in England, you have relatively independent knights and a strong king. In France, you have very powerful feudal lords, a weak king. And so what we'll argue is that, in fact, the reason that England could sustain the system of independent adjudication, a jury system, is that to a much greater extent than in France, the juries in England could make their decision and give their testimony without fear of reprisals from powerful feudal lords, whereas in France, the only sustainable system of adjudication was one where the king protected the judges, where the judges worked for the king. Let me just show you a very simple model picture of what we have in mind. And there is a paper by Ed Glaser and myself in the Quarterly Journal of Economics where you could look at the details. So suppose you have a bunch of crimes whose severity is ranked along the x-axis. So severity of crime is greater to the right and smaller to the left. And let there be a point of zero where to the right of this point it's efficient to punish a person, and to the left of this point it's efficient to let them go. Now there is a second dimension here, which is friendship with the sovereign or political connections, and of course those connections should be immaterial to whether or not a person is punished or not. Now, what would happen with a system of impartial judges or juries? Well, some of the powerful people who've actually committed crimes are going to try to bully the jurors, to bribe the jurors, to bribe the judges in order to avoid punishment. And so they will exert some pressure, which is here denoted by P, to avoid being punished. So P here is a measure of disorder in a country. It's a measure of the extent to which local interests, local powers can subvert justice. So what will happen if you have the system of of this kind of decentralized impartial adjudication? Well, people who have committed only moderate crimes or crimes of moderate severity will be able to avoid being punished by bullying the juries. So in this range where the severity of punishment is between zero and P, they will avoid being punished, they'll be let go, which will create, of course, an inefficiency because they have violated the law or have violated a community standard. Notice, of course, that in this particular instance, the friendship with the sovereign is irrelevant in terms of what will be the failure of the system. And this is, in fact, a very simple way of thinking about decentralization or market systems or lack of sovereign control in general, which is the measure of inefficiency of this system is the ability of the powerful to get their way or to subvert the workings of the system. So if you want to think about monopoly, if you want to think about subversion of justice, if you think about various other market failures, you can think of P as a measure of inefficiency. Now, what would happen, on the other hand, if you have centralized justice? If instead of delegating things to the jury and people who would enforce the law community standards, you will have you will delegate decision making to a king's employee, to the employees of the king, to state employed judges. Well, presumably, if the king employs his judges, he is going to be able to protect them from being bullied or subverted or killed, and therefore there will be no losses associated with disorder. There will be no losses associated with the bullying of the judges. But there will be another problem, which is the king's judges are going to favor his friends and punish his enemies. And so you have a very different set of problems associated with centralization and with delegation of decision-making authority to the employees of the king, which is to say that their preferences will be distorted relative to efficiency. The diagonal line represents the decision rule of state-employed judges. They're going to let go some of the king's friends who should be, in fact, punished, and they will punish some of the king's enemies who should, in fact, efficiently be let go. So think about the slope of this line as being 1 over D, where D here is a measure of dictatorship. That is to say, it's a measure of deviation of the king's preferences from those of the social norms or the standards of the community. So this kind of very simple framework lets you think about when common law, civil law, is going to be efficient. It also lets you think about when decentralization versus centralization is going to be efficient. When P is high, that is to say when the world is very disorderly, the losses from decentralized decision-making are going to be very high. That is to say the jurors or independent judges are going to be bullied too heavily, and therefore civil law and centralization will work better. When D is high, that is to say when the distortions from the king's preferences being different from community standards is high, this line is going to be very flat, and those are the situations when common law will work better. In fact, the implication of this is that civil law will work better in democracies than in dictatorships. So this, I would argue, is how one would interpret the experiences of England and France. That is to say that England basically had a much lower P than France did in the 12th and 13th century. It was a relatively peaceful country, and so this system of decentralized dispute resolution, where these local judges could go around, where these judges could go around the country and ask questions of local knights, could function effectively and efficiently, whereas in France, this system would be simply subverted by local interest and therefore a much greater level of centralization and protection of juries and judges by the king was required. Now, this is a quote from one of the leading American historians of French and English law, who wrote, in order to explain this deviation in the 12th and 13th centuries, or divergence as follows. So we return to the question, why France, which started with institutions so similar to the English, followed in the end such a different course? The answer that has been given centers on weakness at the critical times. The marks of weakness had appeared very early. The community courts, analogous to English county and hundred courts, had been captured by local feudal lords during the breakdown of government in the 10th and 11th centuries. When the rebuilding of monarchy began, the French crown lacked the important resource that the Norman kings of England had already put to very good use, that is to say, the jury system. But it was much more than this. Over large parts of France that owed a nominal fealty to the king, great territorial lords had effective control. In them, for long, the king's writ did not run. Even within the king's own domain, there could be no massive enlistment of free subjects whose allegiance, that is to say, jurors, whose allegiance was to the crown as a symbol of national government, transcending and displacing the bonds of feudal tenure. Now, once you start thinking about this problem of controlling law enforcement, you understand how codification fits into this picture. Why is codification standard in civil but not in common law countries? How did these systems emerge? Obviously, codification is much more binding in civil than in common law countries, even to the extent that laws tend to be codified in common law countries. There is still a great deal more room for judicial interpretation. Again, our view goes back to the same problem of control of judges and the necessity of making sure that justice does not get subverted by local powers. Here's from another great American legal historian. If the legislature alone could make laws and the judiciary could only apply them, or at a later time interpret and apply them, such legislation had to be complete, coherent, and clear. If a judge were required to decide a case for which there was no legislative provision, he would in effect make law and thus violate the principle of rigid separation of powers. Hence, it was necessary that the legislature draft a code without gaps. Similarly, if there were conflicting provisions in the code, the judge would make law by choosing one rather than another as more applicable to the situation. Hence, there could be no conflicting provisions. Finally, if a judge were allowed to decide what meaning to give to an ambiguous provision or an obscure statement, he would again be making law. Hence, the code had to be clear. So the same problem of controlling dispute resolution from above and preventing subversion, I think, sheds light on the importance of codification in civil law countries and the role of codification. Now, of course, as I said, I focused on efficiency. There are other aspects of the problem. You would also, of course, tend to move closer to codification if you put more weight on the welfare of the king. But I think that one of the things that one could emphasize is that even without thinking about the welfare of the king, one can explain differences among legal systems. Now, what's also interesting, and I'll conclude this part of it very shortly, is that other aspects of the legal system could be explained from this point of view as well. Obviously, if you have a system of decentralized dispute resolution where decisions are made based on the information supplied by the locals, and if you don't worry about the problem of subversion, you don't need a system of appeal, or appeal can be rare. On the other hand, if you want to make sure that justice is not subverted, and if you worry a great deal about local interests subverting justice, one way in which you can control judges is by a system of extensive appeal. In fact, this is a striking fact that I think tells you everything you need to know about the difference between the two systems. In the 16th century, France had 5,000 royal judges. England had fewer than 15. Again, written record in civil law, if you want to have a system of automatic appeal and review of judicial decisions to control things from above, you need to write everything down. If you have oral evidence and oral trials, it's much more difficult to have an appeal. In fact, you have very limited appeal in common law systems and very extensive appeal in civil law system. Trial is unimportant in civil law because the judge already has the record. It's obviously the main mechanism of collecting information in common law. There are no separate prosecutors in general, except in criminal situations, and judges already work for the government and have the right incentives, and so on. So I think that many of the features of the fundamental differences between the two systems could be understood from this point of view. Now, why am I talking about 12th and 13th centuries, and what are the consequences of these issues for the things I've started out with? So let me come back to these issues now. What I would like to argue is that this simple model or semblance of a model that I've described to you now suggests something much broader than just differences in patterns of organization of the legal system, and certainly something much broader than these differences in the 12th and 13th century. It points more broadly to different strategies of social control of economic activity and social life more generally. Because civil law stands for a system in which the society in general worries about the problem of disorder and market failure, worries about the problem of private subversion, and trusts the government and the will of the people to deal with it. Whereas common law, in very general terms, I will argue, stands for the opposite. It stands for a system of trust in markets and dispute resolution through courts and distrust in the sovereign. I will try to show that indeed this is what you see in terms of consequences of these different strategies of social control. Notice, by the way, and I should emphasize that these strategies are not extremes. Common law does not mean anarchy. The government has a role, at least through courts, but also through legislation facilitating and enabling private contracting and private relationships. Civil law does not mean the dictatorship of the state and socialism. There is obviously room for markets and contracts, but the two systems are nonetheless different. So in my approach, a legal system is a shorthand for the general pattern of social control, a crucial piece of DNA of a market economy. It describes how things are done on average, and so it allows to evaluate the consequences. But how can we say that legal origin, which was shaped in the 12th century or the latest in the 17th centuries, can matter for areas of law and social control that did not even exist in 1800? Do individual laws get transplanted from mother countries one at a time? The answer to that question is no. The reason that legal origin might have such a pervasive influence is that it shapes the legal infrastructure, including the codes, the structure of dispute resolution, and the human capital of participants. When a country faces a new problem, it generally relies on that infrastructure. As a result, the basic features of legal regulatory infrastructure, summarized by legal origin, become permanent. There is no need for law-by-law transplantation to lead to a legal origin factor across a broad range of laws. And in fact, I'll try to present some evidence supporting these claims. Now, let me make one other caveat, which is something that always gets lawyers yelling at me. I'm not saying that common law or civil law technologically cannot accomplish certain social goals. I'm not saying that common law countries simply cannot put in an extensive ex ante regulatory system, or that civil law countries simply cannot have an area where courts are given much discretion. Such a statement would be verifiably false. What I am saying, however, is that it appears that if you look at the data, if you look at the world, the patterns of social control are sharply different among legal origins, and these have significant consequences for various outcomes that we care about. So what will I do in the next two lectures? In lecture two, the meaning of legal origin, I will try to show empirically that this way of thinking about common versus civil law sheds light on reality, on differences among approaches to regulating market economies, and then the consequences of these differences. I will deal with features narrowly focused on legal systems, such as legal formalism and judicial independence, but also broader aspects of social control, such as regulation of entry by new firms, regulation of labor markets, as well as the military draft. I will show that there is a pervasive gene that expresses itself in all these areas, namely legal origin. In lecture three, I will deal with a particularly controversial area of differences in legal systems, namely patterns of legal protection of outside investors from expropriation by corporate insiders and their consequences for the development of financial markets. I will show that there are profound differences in patterns and strategies of investor protection, that they have enormous consequences, and that these differences can be understood from the same theoretical perspective as I've tried to suggest to you today and will develop further in the second lecture. Let me make one final remark. I will look at various areas of law and their consequences, including, as I said, investor protection and financial development, labor laws, and unemployment. I will not, however, look at growth. Why will I not look at growth if growth is so important? First, the effects of legal origin on growth are indirect, if any, and have never been the focus of my work. Indeed, it is clear from looking at developed economies that all major legal systems, with the exception of socialists, have accomplished the basic goal of securing property, so necessary for investment. Human and physical capital accumulation drives economic growth, and every major legal system is potentially compatible with such accumulation. Still, I think we ought to be quite interested in differences among outcomes other than growth, such as, for example, unemployment or financial development, which are the crucial sources of heterogeneity among market economies. Second, despite an enormous upsurge of research on institutions and growth, the evidence, in my view, remains very, very problematic for several reasons. First, we have very few objective measures of institutions, and measures of institutions that people have customarily used in making statements that institutions cause growth tend to be subjective assessments collected from folks who at the moment are all getting together in Davos in Switzerland. These are outcomes, not institutions, and they improve as countries get richer. The whole research program of regressing growth on subjective institutions, with or without instruments, is fundamentally flawed because it does not measure institutions at all. Indeed, objective measures of institutions we have, political or otherwise, including things like democracy, are generally uncorrelated with growth, as Robert Barrow has shown in his earlier Robbins lectures. To deal with this problem, scholars have tried to focus on instrumental variable techniques, but there is a problem. A valid instrument is not just something that's exogenous or historically determined, it's also something that must be uncorrelated with the error term, if I can make one technical comment. And many instrumental variables approaches used to study institutions of growth have somehow failed to recognize this problem. For example, recent research by Daron Acemoglu and his colleagues, which follows our ideas on the importance of colonial history but looks at settler mortality as an instrument for institutions or a predictor of current income, does not speak to the question of institutions directly. At the most basic level, what did settlers bring with them? One view is that they brought institutions. Another view, which I think is much more credible, is that they brought themselves and their human capital, and therefore, where they settled, they built more successful economies and societies. On this view, consistent with much evidence, it is human capital of colonizers and not the institutions that was a causal effect on growth, that had a causal effect on growth. Now, I will not be able to resolve these issues in these lectures, Instead, what I want to do is to focus on regularities that appear to be more empirically reliable and theoretically supportable than the connection between institutions and growth, namely those between legal origins, patterns of social control of economic life, and the effectiveness of specific institutions and markets. Thank you. If there are some questions, I guess I don't know what the procedure.
I'm going to agree to take questions. Is there a roving mic somewhere? Yeah. Okay, so you just wait for the mic to get to the questioner. We have a few minutes, but I'm going to let Andre regulate his own questions, if that's all right. Yeah?
Right. Okay.
So if anyone would like to ask a question, there'll be a few people who have to go.
No questions.
Okay, question at the back there.
Is that working? Yeah. Thank you, Professor Schleifer, for your lecture. It's very interesting. One little thing that has just occurred to me in my mind, you've looked back into English history, back into the 12th and 13th centuries. I think you might want to direct some of your attentions to the Saxon time. One thing I found, I recently read the Saxon Chronicles, and Edward, Ethelred the Unready was actually expelled from these shores by the nobles, the Saxon nobles, because he wasn't doing his job properly. And the only job of a king at that time was to defend the country. And we had a Saxon Magna Carta actually in this country 200 years before that predated the Magna Carta. And this is a fact of history that I don't think is widely known. So the tradition of independence was very vociferously applied in this country 200 years before the Normans. And the Norman king, William the Conqueror, was actually a second generation Saxon, the son of Rollo. And he brought over himself and French Norman people who imposed their traditions on this country, transplanted their traditions, and the Magna Carta is almost a reaction against the implantation of those traditions and a reversion to more of the traditional Saxon culture. So I like your thesis, but it actually there's a period before the 12th and 13th century that could highlight some things for you there.
I agree with you, and let me just emphasize how limited my knowledge of English history is, particularly before the 13th century or 12th century. But I think that the point you make is exactly right, which is that, as Dawson says in the quote that I've put up, the legal institutions of France and England were quite similar in the 12th century. And then you get this divergence. And the divergence takes the form of continuity in England and discontinuity in France, that is to say, centralization in France. And what I've tried to explain is this kind of divergence. There was a question? Yes?
In the sort of stylized facts that one is usually presented with about law, there are two models. One is, as you say, the English model, case law, precedent, and so on. The other is called the Roman-Dutch model. Now, we haven't heard anything about that in your lecture. Is that because there is no such thing as the Roman-Dutch model? Is that an artificial construct, or how does that fit in? I mean, it's usually regarded as a more important tradition than the French one. I mean, the French codification could be seen as just an example of a Roman-Dutch type system.
I did put up a slide, and just to clarify, I've gone through this too fast, which is that what the French kings have adopted is the Roman model, Justinian model. Now, you know, there are people who debate and say the real Roman law is decentralized law and Justinian codes are a deviation themselves. But let's leave that aside and say that the centralized model of dispute resolution, that is to say the one where judges are not supposed to have much discretion, is the model that went from Justinian, that also influenced the legal model of the Catholic Church, that was rediscovered in Italy, in Florence, in the 11th century, was incorporated first into the legal ideas of the Church, and then was absorbed into the French jurisprudence, into the French legal system, as far as I understand, in the 13th century. So you're absolutely right that the roots of this system are Roman. Well, that's an interesting question. Holland is, of course, is a civil law country. It is, of course, a code country. Its code, at least until recent revisions, was very heavily influenced by Napoleon and Napoleonic code. So I don't really, well, first of all, Holland, of course, was not quite Holland back in the 12th and 13th century. So I think you have me there in not having that knowledge. Maybe any some 20th century questions?
There was a hand.
Thanks. First, a precision. I think you meant Bologna, not Florence, as about the rediscovery of Roman law.
No, that's, they were discovered in Florence. The books were discovered in Florence. The school was in Bologna.
Thanks for the presentation. What about the 20th century question? What about the possibility that everybody at local level plays the part of being friend of the king? I'm thinking of a certain situation like in southern Italy, where throughout the kingdom, the period there was a king, and then during the fascist dictatorship, the rule for local strongmen was to be all, to pretend all monarchist or all fascist, and then there was a sort of a situation whereby the central government played various factions, but they weren't enemy of the king as such, because nobody wanted to be enemy of the king. But still they rigged local juries, and they rigged the judgment of local judges. Basically, what about the gaming of the system by part of the local powers? They pretend to go along with central powers, but in effect they still carry on their interests.
Look, theoretically, a lot of things may happen, and what you're saying sounds right to me. What we try to do is to write down a model or a caricature of a model that I've tried to present, which basically makes a point which I think is quite general, and that is that dictatorship or centralization tends to be a reaction to the problem of disorder, and that decentralization tends to be, again, an efficient reaction, evolutionary reaction, to the problem of relatively greater order and fear of the center. Now, it may be that the facts in different situations are different, and it also may be that the policy choices that arise in different situations are not necessarily efficient, and I think that's an important set of considerations as well. But I think that the general principle that I've tried to use here is important. Incidentally, just as an aside, I think that this I've discussed this principle in thinking about the evolution of the legal systems, but you can also think about this as the principle that applies to the evolution of political systems. So the kinds of subversion of human rights or political freedoms that we see in the United States today is obviously a reaction to the events of September 11th and the perceived disorder that accompanied them. And you can give many other examples. You can also think of this in the context of firms and organizations, which is to say that rules and bureaucratization are to a large extent a response to the problem of disorder, whereas decentralization to a large extent, the problem of fear of inefficiency and bad decisions from the center. So I think all these considerations may be important, but it's the general principle that I want to emphasize. Yes, please. The question was whether within countries in the common law tradition, whether one could subclassify them into countries with constitutions and countries without constitutions. I'm going to talk about constitutions tomorrow, but I can tell you that there are some aspects of constitutions. I haven't looked at all aspects of constitutions, but some aspects of constitutions are clearly very intimately tied to the common law tradition. So, for example, lifetime appointments of judges are very much a common law thing, and countries in the common law tradition would have much greater emphasis, much longer terms of their highest court judges than countries in a civil law tradition, on average, just as an example. There are other aspects of constitutions that seem to be orthogonal to the legal tradition. So, for example, countries that have borrowed their, whose constitutions were influenced by the United States, often have presidential regimes. So I do not want to suggest, and this is a very important point that you've raised, and I want to emphasize it. I do not want to suggest that legal origin explains everything. I mean, the DNA image is designed precisely to make the point that we're looking at one piece of the DNA that seems to have some pervasive influences. There are obviously other aspects of the codes, of the genetic code, if you like, of different countries, including their political systems, including their cultures, including their religion, that also often have a pervasive influence that is also often subject to transplantation, and one can think about studying the effects. But that's as much as I can tell you about constitutions. You sure?
You can be brief, that's right. Thank you for your lecture. I have a question concerning the transition economies from the X.
Relate to law, or
yes.
Is it?
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Sure.
I'll try not to drift away from the topic. My question is, you're mentioning that they're kind of transforming their legal systems at the moment. And given, for example, the general model that you had now, I realize that it's general and a simplistic model, but there are obviously problems in these countries that relate to disorder, and also to this distortion about, you know, being friends with a sovereign. From reading some of your other work with Laporta and the other authors, I do, however, realize that you seem to argue that there are benefits from the civil law tradition regarding, for example, their financial markets, etc., that might benefit development in that sense. So given that there seem to be some points that are for moving towards the civil law direction and some points for moving towards the common law direction, what would you suggest would be a beneficial course of development for their legal system?
Well, that's a fantastic question, and I'm going to spend the next two lectures trying to grapple with that question precisely, which is to say what are the trade-offs and how we think about it. I think that you're absolutely right, which is in thinking about regulation of various markets and social control of various markets in developing countries and in transition economies, one needs to think about the trade-off, and one needs to think about how costly is disorder, and on the one hand, and one needs to think about how costly is dictatorship if you try to, how costly is government regulation. On the other hand, I think, first of all, raising the question even in this way is helpful already because one can avoid simplistic extremes. I think that there are some areas where the data speak pretty unambiguously as to where you want to be. So, for example, in areas where competition can work well, for example, the entry of small firms, you might want to be at the extreme of virtually no government regulation, and so on. In other areas, for example, financial markets, I think that the common law approach in transition and developing countries is unlikely to be effective, and we already see that many of these economies, to the extent that they do have access to financial markets, are doing their business in London, as are in fact large companies in all developing countries. So I will talk more about this, but I do think the central question, there is a central question of the trade-off. No more? Okay.
Okay. It remains to me just to propose a vote of thanks for this particular lecture, but as you know, it's just the first of three, so we look forward to welcoming you back tomorrow evening. For those of you who are invited to the reception, it'll take place now in the senior dining room. So thank you, Andre, and we look forward to the remaining lectures.